right, Wednesday morning Bible study on the Gospel of John. We're going to do the first part of chapter 19 today. So if you remember, when we met last week, we were in chapter 18. And chapter 18 is Jesus being arrested by the group led by Judas. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane. We get some extra details in the Gospel of John that we don't in the other Gospels. Of course, there are some details left out in John that are included in the other Gospels, like Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, for instance. And so they arrested Jesus, and then he's on trial. I should have scrolled up to, I'll go back real briefly to chapter 18 on the screen. So there we are, chapter 18. So Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then he's before Annas and then Caiaphas. And Peter denies Jesus, so we get that story too, where he's confronted three different times. And one of the questions that Jesus is being interrogated for is about his disciples. So certainly, I'm sure they were afraid. Look what's going on with Jesus. We don't want to be caught in that. So that gives a little bit of context, but nevertheless, Peter was normal, not his normal brash self. Instead, he denies Jesus three times, and then the rooster crows, and he realizes what he did, and he goes out and wept bitterly. So that's kind of the end. And then they take Jesus before Pilate, and then we covered this a little bit too, right? Pilate interrogates him, and are you a king? And Jesus says, you say that I am. And then Jesus says, for this purpose I came, to bear the truth. The truth that he is the savior of the world, and Pilate answers with that great postmodern, modern day philosophical question, what is truth? Truth is different for everybody. No, truth is a standard that is verifiable and true for all people. But that's not what some in the world would say. All right. And then Pilate realizes Jesus is innocent, so he tries to get Jesus released by agreeing with the policy or the tradition that the Jews have of releasing someone at Passover. And so he brings forth this notorious criminal, Barabbas, and the crowd shouts for Barabbas rather than Jesus. And right there is the first fulfillment of Jesus' purpose. He came to replace sinful humanity. And who's the first person he replaced?
Barabbas.
Sinful Barabbas. Who was, remember we talked about this too, he was a robber, and then the other Gospels say he was an insurrectionist and a murderer. So which was it? Well, the answer's obvious.
Yes.
All three. He was everything, so he had a long rap sheet. And so he was known to be a rather villainous criminal. All right, now Barabbas was a robber. So there we go. That's the end of chapter 18. And then now we're going to jump into 19. Any thoughts or questions from last week or from chapter 18? Yeah, Mark.
With Barabbas being somebody who was causing problems for the Roman government, or trying to, it sounded to me like, it seemed odd to me that Pilate would agree to that when they just got done saying that they have no king but Caesar. You know, because it seems like that the Jews were acting like they were supporting the Roman government.
Right.
And then, so he goes along with that, but then he has to turn loose a guy who was against the Roman government.
Yeah,
that
right.
That seems very odd to me.
To me, that seems very odd too. I agree. I think Pilate likely picked the vilest criminal that was in their prison at the time to try and convince the crowd to release Jesus, because he knew Jesus was innocent. He probably thought in his mind, being a polytheist and a Roman, he probably thought, oh, this Jesus is some crackpot religious figure. And it says in the other Gospels that he knew, it doesn't say that in John, he says that he knew the Jews brought Jesus to him out of jealousy. You remember that? Mm-hmm. I don't remember which of the Gospels it says that, but that's elsewhere. So Pilate, he's like, I don't want to get involved in this. So he's probably picked the most vile criminal he had in jail to offer as a contrast to Jesus, and it failed. The crowd asked for Barabbas. So yes, it does seem awkward that Barabbas actually was a rebel against the Roman government and very likely would have been crucified himself in the near future. Right.
Pastor?
Yeah.
I had looked it up and, excuse me, I got my morning voice.
And the name Barabbas means son of the father.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting that
he's
releasing the son of the father for the son of the father?
Yes. Right. I should have brought that up last week. You're right. Barabbas, bar, is the Hebrew word for son of, and Abba is the Aramaic word for father, so son of the father. You're right. And so there is some irony there, and you know, there's a lot of this double meaning and irony and double entendre in the Gospel of John. We've been pointing it out all along, right? There's another one, where the son of the father, so named Barabbas, is released and replaced by the Son of God, which you could say is Son of the Father. So, yes, good. Thank you, Joanne. That's a good point. All right, yeah, Sandy.
I don't know. Is there anything in the Bible, I don't recall it, if there is, about what happened to Barabbas after he was left loose?
There is nothing known.
I didn't think so.
And there isn't anything either in early church records, like in the church fathers writing, you know, that this is blah, 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 happened to Barabbas afterwards. We have no idea. So did he go back to his rebellious, murderous ways? Or was he convicted by Jesus and seeing Jesus die and rise again? And so he became a follower? We have no idea. Yeah. All right. All right, chapter 19. We'll get into this maybe about halfway through. We'll see how far we get. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. So right off the bat, first of all, doesn't it seem a little ironic we're talking about this at this time of year when we're preparing for perhaps the cutest and cuddliest of all holidays in the calendar? Oh, Christmas is such a wonderful little holiday, and we remember Jesus being born, and he was, and it's an important holiday, one of the two big holidays in the church. And now here, of all timing, in our Bible study, we're talking about Jesus being flogged and crucified. I didn't plan it this way, but I like it. It's a good reminder, you know, the kind of the juxtaposition of this cute little story about Jesus' birth being kind of contrasted with Jesus' horrific death. Yeah, Debbie?
Without Christmas, we couldn't celebrate Easter.
Right, that's right. Exactly right. Yeah. Okay, so a little word about being flogged. Pilate knows of his innocence. And if we merge together the four Gospels here, we know, and we will see it a little bit here as well, why did Pilate have Jesus flogged? Well, looking at the timing of all four Gospels with this, it appears this might have been, I think, Pilate's last attempt to get Jesus released. Okay, we'll flog him, which is a horrible and painful thing, and sometimes the victim would die from the flogging. But the Romans being, frankly, sadists, and they were good at punishment and abuse, they could flog somebody with an inch of their life but not kill them. So Pilate may be thinking, I'll have him flogged, and then the crowd will have compassion upon him and stop shouting for his crucifixion. That may have been. Now, it was also sometimes the case, but not always, that the Romans, kind of as a pre-crucifixion cruelty, would flog a condemned prisoner. So they may have done that as well. So what is the reason Pilate had him flogged here? I think it's that first reason I mentioned. Maybe one more attempt to draw compassion from the crowd. Now, when they flogged somebody, and some of you know this, and you've heard it from me and other pastors as well, yes, it's part of Jesus' suffering. They would have a cat of nine tails, was most common what they would use. So it would have these long braided leather ropes. And what did they have at the end of each of those braids? A stone or a bone or a nail or something sharp like that. So when they would whip somebody, then those sharp pieces would scrape across their back and just gouge their flesh and draw a lot of blood out as well. So, yes, it was a horrible thing. I think it'd be a horrible thing to watch. And yet, you know, the Romans viewed the Jews as no better than animals. mere barbarians. They're not civilized like us Romans. After all, we control the world and we have the greatest economy the world has ever known. We have the greatest military the world has ever known. And these rebels, they worship one God? Are you really? Seriously? We understand that, you know, so the Romans really despised the Jews and looked down upon them. The Jews, of course, hated the Romans as well. So I think for some of the soldiers, this became sport for them to persecute and torture Jewish prisoners. All right? All right, so they flogged him, and yes, many victims would often die from that. All right, then in verse 2, and the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. Now, this was not usual. Why did they put together a crown of thorns? What is Jesus accused of being?
King of the Jews.
So here again is the soldiers, probably without Pilate's direction, but maybe with Pilate's knowledge. They mock Jesus by saying, oh, you're king of the Jews. That's what you are, huh? That's what they accuse you of. That's what we're looking at you're being on trial for. So we're going to give you a crown. And so it's a mocking crown, a crown made out of thorns. And now I see in some commentaries, we don't know what kind of plant the thorns came from, but some of the thorns, depending on the plant it came from, could have been fairly long, inches long. Of course, even if they were short thorns, like on a rose bush, that's still going to hurt, right? Because they're going to make this crown and then push it onto his head, and what's going to happen? It's going to dig into his scalp, and there's going to be more pain and more blood dripping down his face. And they arrayed him in a purple robe. Why a purple robe?
That's a sign of royalty.
Sign of royalty. Now here again, just a little side note to bring it up in case somebody says, well see, your Bible is inconsistent, because the other, some of the other Gospels say it was a red robe. The Romans used red or purple as capes, especially among their officers. So centurions and governors, they would wear a red or purple cape. The answer to, well, the Bible's inconsistent. Is it red or is it purple? And the answer is yes. You know, two different people describe the same color two different ways, right?
And men are colorblind.
Some men are colorblind, yes. So Jill will say, we're going to repaint the ceiling white. And I'll say, okay, white. That sounds good. And she'll say, which color white? So, for instance, I tend to think, and I tell the kids this, that the cape was probably the color of our hymnals. And by the way, I don't think that's on accident, that CPH chose that color for our new hymnals. Remember the previous hymnal was blue?
Yes.
The one before that was red?
Right, yes.
What would you guys describe that color as?
Burgundy.
I would say burgundy.
The combination of the two colors together.
Yes. It's like purple and red, isn't it? You put mix purple and red, you get that color. So if somebody sees that color cape that the soldiers are using to mock Jesus as the king, some might say it's purple, some might say it's red. And I actually did look it up in the different Gospels in the original Greek, and the one Greek word is red, and the other Greek word is purple or violet. So maybe they didn't have a word for burgundy or maroon. Maybe that'd be another description, right? Is that maroon? Maybe. So that's the easy answer to that particular question. Now, a detail we don't get here in verse 3. Let me read verse 3. They came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. "Hail, King of the Jews." Again, mocking tone. As much mocking tone as you can put into that. That's what they would have said. And struck him with their hands. So that makes you think they're slapping him. In the other Gospels, I did look it up. I think it's in Matthew. Matthew says they put a reed in his hand and then did what? Struck him on the head with the reed and spit on him. Now, that would be inappropriate behavior for any king, even a foreign king, even a king who's not your king. You don't disrespect somebody like that. Plus, the reed is supposed to represent what? A scepter, and then they're hitting him on the head with the scepter, so called, the reed that they give him. And why are they hitting him on the head with it? What's it going to do?
Pounded him.
pound that crown of thorns in further, and then spitting on him besides. So now he's oozing blood all over, and they're spitting on him besides. Yes, it's very demeaning. Absolutely. All right, struck him with their hands, so probably slapping him is what that sounds like. Not struck him with their fists. That would have been a different word. All right. Verse 4. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So this is why I think Pilate's motivation was probably to convince the crowd that Jesus is innocent. Why would the crowd, seeing Jesus bloodied and bruised and beaten from this flogging, with this mock crown of thorns and this cape and a reed in his hand, why would Pilate say, I find no guilt in him? What's the connection there? It's an obvious thing.
He doesn't show that he's king, he's more the opposite.
Yeah. The Romans beat him to the point where he did not confess that he was a king. So he's innocent. He is not claiming he's being rebellious against the Roman Empire. That would have been the biggest thing the Romans would have had an issue with. Pilate would have had an issue with. See? Look at, we've tortured him and he didn't break. He didn't confess. He didn't claim he's a rebel. Here he is. Look at how badly we've tortured him into an inch of his life. And he still claims the same, which is nothing. So, see, he's innocent. That's what that means. See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him. So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." That's a little famous statement there, right? You see that like in movies about the life of Jesus or Pilate or biblical movies, etc. Behold the man. The actual words in Latin are ecce homo, behold the man, but in the Greek it's idioha anthropos. Behold the man. Now that is interesting, that here again is another double meaning from Pilate. Is Jesus a man?
Yes.
He is showing, Pilate is trying to make the statement here that Jesus is a mere man. Look at, he's bleeding. The gods do not bleed. That's what Pilate would be insinuating from this. If he were really a god, as you Jews are afraid, and you claim he says he's a god, so he's blaspheming, and you want him killed, if he were a god, he wouldn't be bleeding. Look at, there's blood all over him. Behold the man, not behold the god, not behold the king. Behold the man. Now, is Jesus a man?
Yes.
Did he have to be a man?
Yes.
Yes. Is he also king or God?
Yes.
But if he were strictly or only God or king, he could not be our substitute. He had to be a man, human that is, in order to be our substitute. So what Pilate is saying here is to insinuate that this is not a god, this is not a king, he's a mere man. But the reality is, he's saying, he's a man like you and me. Therefore, his sacrifice will be the equivalent for us. Pilate doesn't realize he's saying that. It's only after the fact that followers of Christ realize that's what's being said here. Okay? Everybody with me? All right. When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." So the chief priests are the ones stirring up the crowd. The crowd may have had some semblance of compassion and might have shouted for Jesus' release, or, you know, okay, that's fine, you don't need to do anything more. The chief priests have probably planted their own people, their own followers amongst the crowd and start crucifying him. And when you get a crowd going in a certain direction, it's hard to stop them. Right? It becomes a borderline riot. And that's what Pilate fears. Alright, why does Pilate fear that? Anybody know a little bit of history? Yeah, Becky?
It would interfere with his political aspirations. I think there was already a lot of history of unrest in that area. So if he couldn't handle an insurrection, he would be demoted.
Exactly right. So a little bit of history of Pilate. He was appointed by Tiberius at the suggestion of one of the Roman generals who knew Pilate. Pilate was coming up through the military ranks. So Pilate was appointed by Tiberius to be governor over this little backwater corner of this armpit area of the Roman Empire. And the general who recommended Pilate later on, before this time, but after the time Pilate became governor, was caught in an insurrection against Tiberius and executed. How does that make Pilate look? So Pilate is on thin ice right there. Then he's had to put down some rebellions among these Jewish people in the previous couple of decades, you know, in the previous time. These Jews, they're a rebellious people. They keep kind of rebelling. They want their own thing. And so he keeps having to put these down. So he's on thin ice with Caesar. All right? And he knows, you know, one more bad rap coming from Palestine, coming from Israel, and Pilate could be removed or demoted or, I suppose, even executed, but probably not that. So, yes, he's on thin ice, and he's trying to get himself out of this political pickle that he's in. Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." Now, I think that's a throwaway statement that Pilate is saying, we're not going to do anything. You deal with it yourself. However, just the plain sense of the words, the Jews could have said, "Oh, you just maybe unknowingly gave us permission to execute him. Let's take Jesus back and execute him." But they knew they couldn't really do that. He's under Roman guard now. He's probably standing up on the steps or the head of the crowd at the place where they're doing this, and the crowd is below, and they couldn't get to Jesus. They couldn't get him. Plus, I don't think that was a sincere statement by Pilate. Could the Jews crucify? No. If they were to execute Jesus, how would they do it?
Stoning,
right. So Pilate saying, "You crucify him," well, it's kind of a nonsense statement, because first of all, even though it sounds like he's giving them permission, they can't crucify, and actually, according to their own law, they don't. You know, Old Testament law is execution by stoning when it was necessary. The Jews answered him, verse 7, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Oh boy. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So, the fact that now the truth comes out. Do you remember what's going on here? Going back to verse 18. What was the first thing the Jews said to Pilate? "If he weren't guilty, we wouldn't have brought him to you." That's an evasive answer. "Trust us, he's guilty of something. You go crucify him." Well, Pilate's too smart for that. No, I'm not going to trust you guys. What's going on here? And then what's the next thing they say? "Well, he claims to be king, so he's a rebel. He's an insurrectionist against you." Ah, that wasn't true either. Pilate could see through that. He talked to Jesus. "Are you a king?" "Well, who told you that I'm a king? What is the truth?" You know, all that. Now, the truth comes out from the Jewish leaders. Jesus claims to be Son of God. Well, Pilate believes there's a multitude of gods. Polytheism. Could this Jesus be another one of those gods? Now Pilate is a little bit afraid. He's afraid right there. He was even more afraid. So he entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, so he brings Jesus back inside the doorway. "Where are you from? Are you a god? Are you from Mount Olympus? Are you from the earth? Where do you come from? I want to know. They're accusing you now. I think I see the truth. They think you're a god and they want you out of the way. So where are you from?" But what did Jesus do? Gave him no answer. Verse 10. So Pilate said to him, "Will you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Well, that's true. Does Pilate have that authority? Yeah, God given. So he does have that authority, but that authority came from whom? Jesus, who's standing there before him. Right? Will you not speak to me? Don't you know I can release you or crucify you? Ah, that elicits a response from Jesus. Verse 11. You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. Jesus is not there forcibly. He is, but he's not. Could he have escaped?
Yes.
Even after they arrested him, could he have gotten himself released?
Yes.
Yes. Could he have refuted the charges? Yes. That might have convinced Pilate. Could he have called down? He tells Pilate in the other gospel, one of the other gospels, I forget which one, I could call 10 legions of angels, or whatever he says, 10,000 angels to come down and to my aid. No, he doesn't do that either. Jesus is there voluntarily. So the fact that Pilate threatens him with authority is no threat. Jesus is there on his own accord. Beyond which, again, the double meaning here, the irony here is that Jesus is the one who gave Pilate that authority. Jesus as God gave Pilate the authority to release or crucify prisoners. All right, you have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Now talking about from above, Pilate, you know, the Romans had a concept of the afterlife in their polytheism. So he knows that, again, Jesus is referencing some higher power here. So, again, he's afraid. And Jesus says, therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. Now, there's a little bit of controversy on that statement. Who is it that delivered Jesus over to Pilate?
Well, that was Caiaphas, wasn't it?
I always thought this was a reference to Judas.
Oh, yeah.
And it may be. Actually, different commentators, even different Lutheran commentators, kind of discuss and debate a little bit who's this referring to. Could it be Judas? Some say yes. That's what I have always thought. But I saw it somewhere else in another commentary that some say this is Caiaphas.
Caiaphas, yeah.
He's the high priest in charge. Even though Annas is really in charge, right? Because that's where they took Jesus first. So is this really referring to the high priests that are led by Caiaphas? Maybe. Is he also guilty of a greater sin? Yeah. Maybe it's both. Maybe it's Judas and Caiaphas, right? The point is, Pilate is therefore guilty of a lesser sin. Do you ever hear Lutherans talk about this? Greater sins and lesser sins?
Only in reference.
Not much.
Almost never.
Right. And
guess what? That's on purpose. Because which condemns you, a greater sin or a lesser sin?
All sins.
All sins condemn you. And yes, there is some Catholic theology that there are mortal sins and venial sins. And they have to be accommodated or addressed in a different manner. And so we as Lutherans, Martin Luther, would say those Catholics are getting all worked up about grading sins, which are worse and which are less worse. Okay? And we would say it doesn't matter. They all condemn you. And so we don't talk about greater sins and lesser sins on purpose for fear that somebody's going to say to themselves in their own mind, well, that was just stealing a cookie. God's not going to condemn me for that. After all, I'm not like Adolf Hitler or something.
If you eat it,
it's just a cookie.
It's only a cookie.
But if I were truly stealing that cookie, thank you, Shornhurst. I'm not stealing, they gave it to me. If that were truly theft, would God condemn you for that?
Yeah.
Yes. Doesn't matter if you're stealing a cookie or murdering thousands of people. It's still wrong and disobedient and sinful. So, there is such a thing as a greater sin and a lesser sin. But we don't talk about it, because we don't want people to start thinking, well, my sins are lesser sins, therefore I'm okay. No, all sins condemn you. So we rarely talk about this in the Lutheran Church. Questions or comments? Come on, I gotta finish eating my cookie. Linda.
I have, this will take you probably one another cookie. One. The group that were there were the people that I think came when they arrested him. So you don't have a lot of people from Palm Sunday in this group.
Probably not.
So then the next thing is that it talked about taking Jesus to Herod. Was that the same Herod that when he was born that the wise men came to? But it's like ironic that he's taking him back to a Herod.
Yes. This would be that Herod's son.
Okay.
So Herod the Great is the one who rebuilt the temple in order to curry favor with the Jewish leaders, even though he was only half Jew. And he was the one who tried to execute the baby Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He died, and then the family, the Holy Family, returned from Egypt when they heard the news he died. But then his son, he had three sons, and they divided up governance over Palestine. And so this is Herod the Lesser, the son of Herod the Great. So yes, he knows about his dad's cruelty, and you know, he comes from that same line. He's half Jewish. The Jewish leaders don't really like him because of that. It is a different Herod, though.
But it's like he shows up, Jesus shows up, and the person still doesn't know him.
Yeah, right, right.
And then the last thing is, when you said that they spit on him,
mm-hmm.
what is the time that just a few chapters earlier we talked about how Jesus spit on the ground and put mud on his eyes, and so it sort of brings another closure to.
Yeah, that's a good thought. I never really connected that. Now everything in the Bible is connected. So Jesus used spit to make mud to heal a blind man.
To open his eyes.
And now here, people are spitting on him. Is there a connection there? Yeah. It's all connected in meaning. So Jesus is using part of his presence, his spit, to cure a person of their sinful their blindness caused by sin. And then some other people are returning that back to him in the form of mockery. Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I'd have to ponder that a little bit more, but that could be a good topic of a devotion. Or maybe even bubble up into a sermon. Potty like that.
Are you done with the cookie?
Yes.
Okay, if I say one more thing.
Absolutely.
When you mentioned that, you know, Jesus voluntarily was there, I would not personally use that word. I would say willingly, because it was God's will that he followed the plan that he had laid out for him.
Sure.
So he willingly was there, but I wouldn't say...
Yeah, that's true. I think willingly would be a better word than voluntarily. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, Anne?
So, I'm wondering, the Jews know who Jesus is, and is this the first time that Romans would have been aware of the man?
No.
They would have known about him before this?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. They knew of him. They may not have had too many interactions, but remember, the centurion came to Jesus, "Heal my servant. I've heard about you, this Jewish rabbi who can do miracles. My servant, my trusted, most beloved servant is dying. Can you heal him?" And, "I have not found such faith in Israel." And, you know, "Your servant will be healed." And at that moment, from afar, you remember that whole story?
Sure.
The Romans knew of Jesus. The Jews had lots of rabbis. There would be rabbis that would be in charge of each of the synagogues in all the towns and villages. So, yeah, Jesus was known by the Romans, but they didn't think much of it. He's just another rabbi. You know, and there's these rumors about miracles, but we don't care. That's some religious thing going on. Are they real miracles or not? We don't know. So the Romans, yeah, they would have known of Jesus, but they didn't really care much until now.
The Jews the priests were using that because that was when they said that one man shall die.
Yes, exactly right. That wonderful ironic statement, double meaning from a couple chapters ago. Right. Better that one man should die. All right. Other questions or comments? Good stuff. Good stuff. Yeah, Sandy.
I've always thought that, you know, we were talking about him being beaten and all that stuff that they did to him before, that in a way, that was a help to Jesus because he died sooner.
I suppose I've never thought of it that way.
To break his legs or anything
like
that.
Yeah. Possibly. It appears to us, although we don't know for sure, that the other two criminals were not flogged or beaten. They might have been, but probably not. And yes, it was known that it could take up to 2 days for a criminal to suffer and die on the cross. That was part of the purpose of crucifixion, was to make the victim suffer, to make the victim ashamed, because it's a shameful death, and to make it last as long as possible on the edge of death. No food or drink, you're hanging there on the cross, you're exposed to the elements, and, you know, barely alive, but alive enough. And so it would often take up to 2 days. So yes, the fact that Jesus died in 3 hours was probably due to the flogging. You're right, and it saved him from having his legs broken.
That was also part of the prophecy.
That was broken, right? That's correct, part of the prophecy as well. Right, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, you might, I suppose, I never thought about it, but yeah, you could say, well, the flogging allowed Jesus to die more quickly. Oh yeah, maybe. Probably.
Having the sins of the whole world on his back too.
Yeah, that's the worst part of it. You have heard me say, and I've said this, I don't know if Pastor Q or Pastor Yeager have said this or not, they may have, but I know in Good Friday sermons, I have said periodically, regularly, the worst part of the crucifixion was being forsaken by God the Father because he carried the sins of the world. My God, why have you forsaken me? He was abandoned, and right in that moment, the Trinity was torn asunder. God the Father rejected God the Son. So yes, all the pain, all the torture, you know, all of the mockery, all of the beatings and all the rest of it was awful. I personally think the worst part of it was being abandoned. So that moment. Yeah. Okay, good stuff. Any other questions? Yeah, Debbie?
The Romans used the fear that crucifixion to control people.
Yes.
Stay in line, otherwise this could happen to you.
Right.
And so it was ugly.
Correct. It was ugly. And it was done right on the public byways and right outside the entrances to cities. So everybody would see it. Right. Exactly right. Yeah. Wow. Kind of a serious moment, a Good Friday moment here in the middle of Advent, huh? Like I said, weird contrast for us, having all these colored blinking lights on the wall and then thinking about our Savior dying for us. I think it's a good contrast. It's a good thing for us to ponder and remember. Yeah, Sally.
Do you know when they started it and was it done in other places besides Jerusalem?
Crucifixion? Well, actually looking it up at one point, not recently, but the Persians started the practice of impaling their victims or their criminals, impaling them on a pole. The Romans altered that, or in their words, improved that to the point where it would allow the victim to be prolonged in life for a day or days. So actually the practice had roots in the Persian Empire, but it was updated, changed, and perfected, if you want to call it perfection, weird, by the Romans. And it was done on purpose to be ugly and gruesome as a way to control the crowds. Exactly right, as Debbie mentioned, yeah. So it is a Roman practice, even though it has some origins elsewhere. Okay. Wow. Okay, let's move on. Verse 12, from then on, Pilate sought to release him. Well, then on isn't very long. It's probably a matter of some numbers of minutes, 10, you know, a dozen, a couple dozen minutes. He's probably like, what has he done? He's probably yelling back at the crowd, you know, trying to get the crowd to calm down and get so that he can release Jesus without creating a riot. So in verse 12, when it says, from then on, Pilate sought to release him, that wasn't a particularly extended period of time, but it was probably Pilate trying to control the crowd. But the Jews cried out, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. So they're going back to the political pickle that Pilate is in, and they know about it. And actually, there's a little more weight here. There was a title in the Roman government of Caesar's friend. That was a title given to people of high authority within the government. And if you were not one of, quote-unquote, Caesar's friends, you could not rise to certain positions. So you had to have the favor of Caesar, the agreement of Caesar. It's almost like Caesar had the right to appoint, like our president today would appoint the top-level cabinets. That would be the same thing. So they use that word on purpose, that phrase, Caesar's friends. That's a weighted phrase because they know Pilate's on thin ice. So there's an implied threat here. If you don't do what we want, we're going to make sure word gets back to Caesar. And you will be undesignated as Caesar's friend, and that's the limit of your political advancement. You'll go no further. In fact, you probably drop in authority and in rank. So that's a kind of a threat right there from the Jews. And they go back to saying, anyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar's. Now, Pilate already has seen the truth. They're jealous of Jesus because they claim Jesus says he's a God, son of God, which he is. And it is true, although Jesus doesn't really openly claim that. How does he refer to himself most of the time? Son of man, which is a messianic title, but it's more ambiguous, a little more vague. All right, verse 13. So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement. In Aramaic, Gabbatha. You know, I don't think I looked that word up. I should have. What does this say? Oh, it's also talking about other words there. Okay. Gabbatha, so the stone pavement. Now, it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." So, first of all, the preparation of the Passover. Remember we talked about the timing here. Preparation of the Passover or preparation of the Sabbath? Preparation of the Sabbath. Except here it says preparation of the Passover. But if this is the day of preparation, which is the day before, Jesus just celebrated the Passover that the night before, which would be part of the day of, with his disciples on the upper room, right? So remember, we talked about this, was it last week or the week before, about the timing? So how do we understand this? The day of preparation of the Passover. Did the Passover start that day, or was the Passover the next day? Well, there is some ambiguity here, because there's no punctuation here in this sentence. Now, it was the day of preparation. Actually, let me look it up, because I looked this up and I studied it a little bit. Oh, the word that's a better translation here would be, now, it was the day of preparation, this Passover. Okay? The pronoun that is, or the I guess it's a conjunction, whatever. The word that is there between the word preparation and Passover is the word this. That's the word. I looked that up because this is kind of confusing. So, now it was the day of preparation, this Passover. So, what does that mean? To me, the way I see it is, that means that what John the Apostle is saying when he writes that is, this is the Passover, and yet it's the day of preparation for what? For the Sabbath, which is tomorrow. So there's a day of preparation for the Sabbath, there's a day of preparation for the Passover. The day of preparation for the Passover was yesterday, the day of preparation for the Sabbath is today. So Jesus is dying on the Passover in preparation for the Sabbath. That's how I see it. There is some confusion or ambiguity here because of the language. Okay? Does that make sense? So again, yes, it is known there is some confusion on the timing of the events here. What is this actual day? But I think it does make sense if you kind of realize there is a little bit of confusion in the language that is used. Okay.
There's an interesting note in my Bible that says, Jesus dies on the day of preparation for Passover, at the same time the sacrificial lambs for the Passover meal are being slaughtered.
Yeah. Well, the lambs would be slaughtered for the Passover. Now, again, there's another thing. There is the Passover day. The day that the Passover starts, that's when the big Passover meal was. Then Passover was also used for the week of the festival following. Like we say Christmas. Well, do you mean Christmas Day? Or do you mean the week of Christmas when you intend to have all the parties and get-togethers with extended family, relatives, and work compatriots at, you know, at work? So Christmas can refer to the day of, or it can refer to the season of, right? They would use Passover the same way. Passover could refer to the event, the day of Passover, or it could refer to the week of Passover, the festival. So, is this preparation? Yeah, for what? Well, I'm not sure. I still think it's preparation for the Sabbath. Could it be preparation for the rest of Passover? So that today is Passover, but they're also preparing for the rest of Passover. I do think that the idea that lambs were being slaughtered at the temple at the same time Jesus is crucified is significant. Because Jesus is the sacrificial lamb, the final lamb. Now, did they have lambs for Sabbath? Yes. Did they have lambs for Passover? Yes. They ate a lot of lamb. How many of you like lamb? I like lamb. Some people don't. To me, it's another red meat. It tastes good. You season it right, you roast it, it's good stuff, I think. Anyway. Mint jelly. Mint jelly, yeah, that's the kind of the common thing with lamb, isn't it? All right. So, yes, there is some confusion here. Preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. Now what would that, when would that be? Noon. The sun would generally rise at 6 o'clock, plus or minus a half an hour, depending on the season, and it would generally set at 6 p.m., plus or minus a half an hour, depending on winter or summer. So this is noon. That's when we generally recognize Jesus was crucified, right? And when did he die? 3 o'clock, right. So he hung on the cross for 3 hours, which, frankly, if you're the one hanging there, that's an interminably long time. Although some of the criminals that were crucified, it would be a day or two. And Pilate speaking, he said to the Jews, "Behold your king. Behold your king." A last attempt, perhaps, at trying to release Jesus. If you guys think he's your king, if you, the crowd, think this is your king, as your Jewish priests are claiming, then wouldn't you want him released? He's not dead yet. He's, you know, suffering pretty badly. It'll take a long time to recover. Behold your king. Well, I think he's appealing to the crowds, and yet what is that statement going to do to the Jewish leaders and the priests? That's going to rile them up worse. They cried out, verse 15, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. So see, this I think is part of the last little bit of an effort on Pilate's part to still try and release Jesus. Because he says, "Shall I crucify your king? You know, what should I do with him?" You know, and they answer, "We have no king but Caesar." Yeah.
Where is it where Pilate washes his hands?
That's in Matthew.
Okay.
That's in Matthew, yeah. So there, again, as we've talked about, we have four Gospels. They all give us little different details, which lends credibility to all of them. Because if you get different people recounting a news story, you're going to get different details from each newscaster. The four Gospels give us a little bit different details, but they all merge together. None of them contradict the others. Okay? Yes, Pilate washes his hands somewhere right in this area here. But that takes place, and we're told about that in Matthew. "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." See the double entendre there? According to the Old Testament, who was the king of the Israelites?
God.
God was their king. He declared to them to be their king. They were supposed to recognize that. And then at some point, they decided they wanted a king like all the nations around them had a king. And God said to them through the prophets, no, you don't want a king. He's going to tax you. He's going to enlist your young men to be in the army. He's going to do all kinds of things, force you to do labor, to build palaces and temples. You don't want a king. I'm your king, he said through the prophets. And the people kept saying, no, we want a king. We want a king, like the other nations have a king. So who was their first king?
Saul.
Who was a big, strong, good-looking man, but was an awful king. Right? So who was supposed to be their king? God. And what do they say? We have no king but Caesar. What's the double meaning there? God is not their king.
They have forsaken God.
They have forsaken God as their king. And here's Jesus, who is God and should be their king. And they have forsaken God in favor of Caesar. Wow. So it's a wonderful double meaning there. I love these in the Gospel of John. All right. We have no king but Caesar. So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. Were they the ones who did the crucifixion? No.
No.
What does that mean? Well, that means that he delivered Jesus over to their will. He finally caved in to their will to say, okay, we'll have this Jesus crucified. We'll do what you want. So by delivering over to them doesn't mean he gave his authority over to the Jewish leaders. It just means he relented to what they wanted. And then verse 16 ends with the very next little bit there. So they took Jesus. And he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of a skull, which in Aramaic is Golgotha. All right, I'm inclined to stop there. Have we been going for an hour?
Yeah.
So if I will jump into the next paragraph, it will be another half an hour. So great. Maybe that's a stopping point.
That'd be good, yeah.
I'll say a couple words, though, to tie this up. Debbie?
I just wanted to take a minute and think about what the believers in Jesus, how they felt seeing all this going on and the religious leaders turning their back.
Yeah.
The Son of God.
Yeah, right.
It's no wonder that the disciples were hiding.
Yes, right. All the leadership is arrayed against Jesus.
Topsy-turvy.
Absolutely, it's topsy-turvy. And it's very corrupt. Many of the people, including the disciples, they know this Jesus, our master, our rabbi, Jesus, he hasn't done anything wrong. In fact, you listen to what he's preached and taught about loving your neighbor and about repenting of your sins and about, God's forgiveness. And he's healed people and he's performed miracles. He hasn't done anything that smacks of rebellion against even the Jewish leaders. So, yes, they see his innocence. This is all corrupt. Yes, this is all topsy-turvy. It's a moment of chaos and the devil loves it, right?
He thinks at this point the devil thinks that he's winning.
Yes, the devil thinks he's winning. Absolutely. So they took Jesus and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of a skull, which in Aramaic is Golgotha. Well, I am prepared to talk about that word Golgotha and what it is in Hebrew and Greek, but that would launch me into this next paragraph. So I'll save it for the next time.
So that would be a spoiler then for the next time.
Yes.
See, spoilers.
I'm insulting your attention.
Yeah, there
when
we
come
go.
Back in 3 weeks.
Yes.
Yeah, what's going to happen? You're wondering. You're on the edge of your seat.
Yes, we are.
To be continued.
Yes.
No spoilers.
Yeah, spoilers. No spoilers.
No spoilers.
Right. So you don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. All right. Any last questions? Comments?
In a sense, you might say that Jesus was crucified through his entire life.
Sure.
By words, by, the actions of the people that he met and how they were so against him. And he just, like you said, at one point, pissed off their feet to the disciples of mm-hmm. John. And, it all led up to the actual event of the crucifixion.
Yes. Right. Yes, there were elements of the crucifixion building all along throughout his life. Absolutely. Resistance and animosity towards Jesus, grew and grew as he continued his ministry, right? Okay. Remember, right after this, I think the soup is probably ready, I'm assuming. Let's see, Linda, you were helping. Is the soup ready?
11:15.
Okay, so hang out for half an hour if you want, or come back a little early for the 1 o'clock service and have some soup. I will probably have 2 bowls myself. All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen. Thanks for coming. Have a good day.